From NPR News, this is special coverage. The Supreme Court upholds the Affordable Care Act, handing an election year victory to President Obama. I'm Jennifer Ludden in Washington. It was a surprise to many after those grueling hearings back in March. Chief Justice John Roberts joined with the court's four more liberal members in upholding the health care law, including the controversial mandate that nearly everyone have insurance or pay a penalty. His reasoning, though, was not the crux of the government's argument. Roberts said the mandate was constitutional because the penalty for not complying is a tax, drawing on Congress's powers to tax and spend. And the court did lay out a limit on both on the law's Medicaid expansion. We'll hear more on both those points in a moment. As with the hearings in March, large crowds gathered outside the Supreme Court for today's decision. For the law's opponents, the ruling was a disappointment.
And to those that are rejoicing that this monstrosity is partially upheld, I've got four little words for you. This is not over.
Two feelings about it. First is deep disappointment. The second is resolution. Be resolute to now have to change Congress, get rid of the people that passed this, and get folks that will repeal it.
That was Kelly Carrender from the Tea Party Patriots Group and Larry Conroy from Virginia. Supporters of the law were there as well.
It's awesome. I'm overwhelmed. It's something that should have happened a long, long time ago. We are moving America in the right direction. We are moving America forward.
I thought this day was not going to happen. My husband has cancer. We know that we're going to be able to have health care. Our oldest doesn't have full-time employment yet. And we know that we are going to be able to provide for him until he has an opportunity to have full-time employment and to get the kind of health care that everyone deserves in this country.
We love Obamacare. We love Obamacare. We love Obamacare.
And there we heard from Beverly Esicoli from Montgomery County, Maryland, and Felicia Douglas from Richmond, Virginia. We're joined now by NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg, NPR's Health Policy correspondent Julie Rovner, National Political correspondent Mara Liasson, and attorney Tom Goldstein, publisher of SCOTUS Blog. And welcome to all of you.
Hi.
Hi.
Nina,
quite a day.
You were there in the courtroom today. We were talking all about Justice Kennedy is the swing vote here for 2 months now. It was Chief Justice John Roberts who saved President Obama's signature achievement. What was it like in the room there?
It was an intellectual roller coaster. First, the Chief Justice started out, and he made it pretty clear that the mandate would not stand if it was done under the Commerce Clause of the Constitution, which was the government's main argument. And then he pivots. He does like a 180-degree U-turn, and he says, but if we look at it as a tax, and even though it's not called a tax, it looks and quacks like a tax, therefore we think it is a tax, and Congress can do this under its tax power. And so it took quite a while for him to do that, and then for the conservative dissenters to dissent, and then for the liberal dissenters who wanted to uphold it under the Commerce Clause to dissent. But it was just an astonishing turn of events that nobody predicted. There were some people who thought the court might uphold the Obama health care overhaul, but I heard nobody say that they thought they would do it as under the tax power, and nobody who thought that the swing vote would be Chief Justice John Roberts, not Anthony Kennedy. There were some people who thought it might be both of them, but never alone Roberts.
Huh. Tom Goldstein, you were among the few who, despite that grueling the law came under in March, said you thought it would be upheld, but did you imagine this?
I didn't imagine this, that's for sure. I had said that, you know, I thought that the administration would win and that John Roberts would write the opinion, but there are two big things here. The first is that the Chief Justice, as Nina says, joins with the court's more liberal members, and there are no cases in his entire tenure as Chief Justice where it was 5-4, and it was him and the more liberal members. He had just one case in his first year that was 5-3 with Justice O'Connor gone. So there was just no precedent for this, and certainly nothing like the precedent of these stakes, the signature achievement of a Democratic president, a conservative Chief Justice, a hero to conservatives in the United States, saving the law, And then also that it was decided on the backup theory, that Congress had sworn up and down, it's not a tax, it's not a tax. President Obama had said it's not a tax. And what we found out actually was, oh, by the way, it's a tax.
Actually, he never said it wasn't a tax. He said it wasn't a tax increase.
So how did that happen? How did Roberts pull that from, was it there in the arguments and we didn't see it, we didn't catch it, or how did this happen?
Well, you know, I remember sitting at this very table. There was a huge amount of discussion about, was the Solicitor General not good enough, not up to the task, that he hadn't been anywhere near as good as Paul Clement arguing for the states. There was a huge amount of discussion about how the government didn't have a limiting principle on the Commerce Clause aspect of the case. But I don't ever remember discussing whether this was going to be upheld as a tax, under the taxing power. Do you, Tom?
No, we talked about the main event, everything that it seemed like the lawyers wanted to talk about, the justices wanted to talk about, and that the taxing was the, you know, kind of junior varsity argument in the case. And it turns out that 2 days later, 3 days later, they went and voted, and it appears that the Chief Justice said, actually, five of us can agree that the mandate is constitutional. We're going to make a bunch of other law, things we might talk about later in the hour, but we're going to save the mandate that way.
This is one area in which the Chief Justice, it seems to me, has been true to what he said he wanted to be as a Chief Justice. He really didn't want to make big law. He wanted it to be as small as possible and not to get in fights with Congress if it could be avoided. And that's what he did here. And there are people who will criticize him and have criticized him for not being true to conservative principles enough. But he did what he said in his confirmation hearings he said he wanted to do, which is to be a minimalist.
And that's going to be true, and he's going to be able, and his defenders are going to be able to say that for the next 20 years during his tenure as Chief Justice. And so when the conservatives on the court, as they are doing, really advance the ball in that direction in a variety of areas of the law, they're always going to be able to turn around and point and say, you can't say that Chief Justice Roberts is a partisan, that this is a partisan Supreme Court. He provided the decisive vote and wrote the health care opinion, and it will be a complete answer to those accusations for a long time.
All right, so now he has said this is constitutional because it is basically a tax. Mara, my inbox has already filled up with all kinds of groups latching onto that. The opposition now has swung, no longer saying it's unconstitutional, saying biggest tax increase in history, I believe, is
right.
One of the headlines in my
inbox.
Well,
it's interesting because the last time we were all in this room, I remember Tommy saying they're having trouble convincing the justices because of a technicality, because they weren't able to say this was a tax, which would have been clearly constitutional. And one of the big questions about their strategy all along was, why not just call it the anti-free rider tax and just explain it as something that's very conservative about individual responsibility, not unlike the way the Heritage Foundation discussed it when they invented it, not unlike the way Mitt Romney discussed it when he passed it in Massachusetts. But the White House felt they couldn't get the votes for this if they called it a tax, so they really did tie themselves up in knots to say it wasn't. And as Tom just said, President Obama famously told George Stephanopoulos, it is not a tax increase. He even said in that interview it wasn't a tax. Now that they've argued in court that it was and that that was the argument that worked, now today the president is beginning, I don't know how much he'll do of this, but he now has to make the argument against, as you said, this unbelievable onslaught of conservative ads and attacks that the president just raised your taxes, everybody, and he promised not to raise middle-class taxes. In fact, I think this tax is going to affect, Julie can correct me, 1% of people, and it's
pretty small.
The highest is $680.
This is the penalty, really.
If you don't get health insurance, and you can say we're not taxing you, we're not forcing you to buy health insurance, we're just going to tax you if you don't have it. I think the White House does have an important decision to make, whether it re-enters the battle that it lost, which was the messaging battle. If they think that they can just pocket this victory and kind of go on as before, I think they'll be surprised, because the right is gearing up to open up a whole new front in the healthcare war.
All right, we're going to get into politics in a few moments, but Julie Rovner, there was another significant thing out of today's ruling. The Supreme Court imposed significant limits on the expansion of Medicaid. Tell us about that.
Yes, this was sort of the forgotten child of this entire argument the whole time, because everybody really thought that the court was not going to do this. It was the last thing that got argued over the days of the debate, and this was whether or not the federal government had basically overreached in requiring the states to expand Medicaid to about 17 million more people. There's about 55 million people on Medicaid program for people with low incomes, and basically the state said, you're blackmailing us into doing this because you're saying if we don't do this expansion, even though the federal government is paying the vast majority of it, states saying, if you don't do this, then you can take away all of our money. And the justices kind of surprisingly...
All their Medicaid money.
All their Medicaid money. And the justices surprisingly agreed with that. But
7-2.
Right. But they did not strike down the expansion. What they said is they're basically looking at the expansion as kind of a separate program. And they're saying that the expansion should be voluntary. So the states can do the expansion or not, but if they don't do the expansion, then they can't be subject to losing all the rest of their Medicaid money.
The court said they could only lose the extra money for the expansion.
That's right. So basically they just said that the expansion is voluntary, as is the rest of Medicaid, but you can't tie the two together.
What does that mean for states?
Well, there had been a lot of concern that this could go further, and it probably won't, because the experts I've talked to today say that they find this a unique situation. But I think a lot of people think that the states will almost every state is expected to do this for two reasons. One, because the federal government's paying almost all the bill. The states, in the end, only have to pay 10%. For the first several years, the federal government's paying the entire amount. The other reason is there's a quirk in the law, which is that the very low-income people who aren't now eligible for Medicaid won't be eligible to get subsidies to help them buy insurance either. So you could end up with a lot of low-income people who wouldn't be eligible for anything. And there would be governors who would then have to explain why you have basically poor working people, because those are the people who aren't eligible for Medicaid, who have no insurance and no access to insurance.
So this may give states more leeway, but they're probably, in the end, going to go ahead with the expansion.
That's at least the consensus of the people that I've talked to.
Yeah. Even Paul Clement, who was the lawyer for the states, said to me today he couldn't imagine a state not taking the money, because how do you say to your citizens, well, your tax money is going to pay for this in other states, but not our state?
How do you say to your citizens, how do you say it to the health companies, the hospitals, and the doctors who would end up with the money?
All right. This decision has major implications for the presidential campaign. We'll get to that in just a moment. I'm Jennifer Ludden. You're listening to live special coverage of the Supreme Court's decision to uphold the Affordable Care Act from NPR News. From NPR News, this is special coverage. The Supreme Court upholds the Affordable Care Act. I'm Jennifer Ludden. President Obama's signature achievement was politically polarizing from the start. Court cases against it were filed within minutes of his signing the law, and the opposition to the law helped fuel the Tea Party movement and other critics of the president. Now, with its 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court has handed Mr. Obama a significant election year victory. The president spoke a couple hours after the ruling was announced. Far from gloating, he took the opportunity to again try and sell Americans on a law that's been little understood and persistently unpopular.
I know there will be a lot of discussion today about the politics of all this, about who won and who lost. That's how these things tend to be viewed here in Washington. But that discussion completely misses the point. Whatever the politics, today's decision was a victory for people all over this country whose lives will be more secure because of this law and the Supreme Court's decision to uphold it. And because this law has a direct impact on so many Americans, I want to take this opportunity to talk about exactly what it means for you. First, if you're one of the more than 250 million Americans who already have health insurance, you will keep your health insurance. This law will only make it more secure and more affordable. Insurance companies can no longer impose lifetime limits on the amount of care you receive. They can no longer discriminate against children with pre-existing conditions. They can no longer drop your coverage if you get sick. They can no longer jack up your premiums without reason. They are required to provide free preventive care like checkups and mammograms, a provision that's already helped 54 million Americans with private insurance. And by this August, nearly 13 million of you will receive a rebate from your insurance company because it spent too much on things like administrative costs and CEO bonuses and not enough on your health care.
The president also outlined the provisions to cover many uninsured people. He said where necessary, he'll work to improve the health care law, but that the battles over it should be put to rest. That, however, does not seem likely. Here's Republican presumptive presidential candidate Mitt Romney.
What the court did not do on its last day in session, I will do on my first day if elected president of the United States. And that is, I will act to repeal Obamacare. Let's make clear that we understand what the court did and did not do. What the court did today was say that Obamacare does not violate the Constitution. What they did not do was say that Obamacare is good law or that it's good policy. Obamacare was bad policy yesterday. It's bad policy today. Obamacare was bad law yesterday. It's bad law today. Let me tell you why I say that. Obamacare raises taxes on the American people by approximately $500 billion. Obamacare cuts Medicare by approximately $500 billion. And even with those cuts and tax increases, Obamacare adds trillions to our deficits and to our national debt and pushes those obligations on to coming generations. Obamacare also means that for up to 20 million Americans, they will lose the insurance they currently have, the insurance that they like and they want to keep.
And there were more assertions out of Congress as Republican members came out swinging. Here's House Speaker John Boehner.
The president's health care law is hurting our economy. It's driving up health care costs. It's making it harder for small businesses to hire new workers. And I think today's ruling underscores the urgency of repealing this harmful law in its entirety. What Americans want is a common sense, step-by-step approach to health care reform that will protect Americans' access to the care that they need from the doctor they choose at a lower cost. And Republicans stand ready to work with a president who will listen to the American people and not repeat the mistakes that gave our country this harmful law. Listen, health care coverage has become too expensive for too many people in our country. The number one concern for families and small business people is the cost of health insurance. And the Republican health care reforms will, in fact, lower health care costs.
Democrats lauded the court's decision. Former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi helped pass the health care law 2 years ago.
Why are we here? We are here to do a job for the American people. We're here to act upon our beliefs. And a belief that we have, many of us shared, is that health care is a right, not a privilege, in our country. We believe that a health care bill needed to be passed so that families would not be pauperized because they had a diagnosis or an accident that heaped health care costs on them. We believe it is about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that people can now pursue their aspirations, depending on their talents and, again, their aspirations, without being job-locked because a child has a pre-existing condition or fear of a diagnosis. They can be a writer. They can start a business. They can be self-employed. They can change jobs.
All right, so two very different reactions there. In addition to the rest of our brain trust here in Studio 3A, we're now joined by NPR Washington editor Ron Elving. Welcome to you.
Good to be with you, Jeff.
So, Ron, Mr. Obama must be pleased today, but how do you expect this to play out in the presidential campaign?
The presidential campaign may not actually be the main focus of where this effect is felt. I think it's going to be a boon for the Tea Party wing of the Republican Party. Already you can sense that Mitt Romney, who would like to pivot away from the primaries dynamic that he was part of and talk more to a more centrist vision of what he would be like as president and relieve a certain amount of anxiety about to what degree he was beholden to some of the promises that he had made as a candidate in the primaries, is being pulled back in. He's going to have to go back to being the Tea Party pleasing candidate that he had to be in order to get the nomination. We heard this already in some of the things that he was saying today, some of the assertions he was making, some of the characterizations he was giving on some of these numbers, as opposed to speaking from the record that he himself built when he was the governor of Massachusetts and put out a bill, in fact made it a law, that was not only much like what it's now called Obamacare, but was actually the model for it for many of the people who wrote the bill in the White House. So instead of being able to pivot to that more centrist position, he's going to have to talk to the Tea Party again. He's going to have to deal with an extraordinarily energized community within the right that is now going to spend even more money than they were spending before. They're going to focus a lot on this issue rather than the ones that Mitt Romney would prefer. And it's also going to affect Senate races and House races, particularly Senate races, as the Tea Party and the other elements that I'm talking about focus on getting a Congress that would repeal Obamacare, no matter who is president.
Although, Maura, they certainly seem to be making an economic issue, talking about this being a job-killing bill and all these taxes it's apparently...
Well, I'm not sure where the $500 billion in tax hikes or the 20 million people who are going to lose their coverage. I don't even know where those come from. But that's something that the White House is going to have to refute. I mean, the problem is, in the past, we saw this. You know, these charges are out there. They're repeated over and over again, and they're not countered in any way by Democrats or the White House. So they become part of the belief of people. I mean, they just didn't do it. This is a second. It's very rare that somebody gets the second chance to make an argument that they lost the first time. But this is a second chance for the president, and I don't know if they're going to take it or not. The other thing is that what will this ruling do to change public opinion, if anything? Now, we know that the law has been unpopular pretty much the whole time it's been out there. That all the energy against it, the energy about it, is against it. The people who are for it aren't for it as strongly as the people who are against it strongly. But the thing that I wonder is, now that the court has ruled, and it has ruled with a bipartisan or left-right coalition, it's given it some kind of a good housekeeping seal of approval. Now, the court might be dropping in the estimation of the American public, but it's still a revered institution. It has to count for something. I just don't know how much. So it'll be interesting to see if the court's stamp of approval changes the minds of some swing voters on this. And we're all waiting for polling.
Julie Rovner.
You know, somebody asked me earlier today who the biggest losers were, and I think actually the biggest losers today may have been the people who wanted a single-payer health plan. They've been really gearing up for the last couple of weeks, hoping that if this was struck down, they might have another moment in the sun. This is
It's been amazing to see the talking point shift. The supporters have kind of said, well, yeah, it may not be the worst thing. Maybe it's a good thing if they strike it down. Yeah.
Yeah, and I've been getting lots and lots of calls and emails from the single-payer people just waiting to jump back in, you know, that if this was going to go away, they were going to get their next chance, and now suddenly, oh, maybe this isn't going to go away.
Julie, you're the maven of numbers. Are these numbers, any of them that Romney said today, 20 million?
$500 billion raises taxes, $500 million cuts in Medicare?
Sort of. Well, yes. In fact, we can go through them. There are $500 billion of cuts in Medicare. Those were done with the express assent of the people who are getting cut with a couple of small exceptions, because they know that they will be getting that money back in the guise of all of these new people who will be insured. So take the case of the hospitals. They said, we will give up the payments in Medicare because now we won't have to give as much uncompensated care to people who are now be getting insurance. Same thing goes for the drug industry. These were all the quote-unquote sweetheart deals that everybody talked about. That's what those sweetheart deals were, to cut Medicare in exchange for getting these people covered. The 20 million people who are going to lose their coverage that they like. A lot of those people have what's considered under this law substandard coverage. They're going to have to move to better coverage. Yes, in some cases it's going to be slightly more expensive coverage, but a lot of those people have what they call these mini med plans, or plans that cover, you know, only $10,000 worth of care a year. That's not considered adequate coverage under this law. So they will lose their plans. They'll have to go to
something
else. Because
those plans will be outlawed, in effect,
correct.
Because they won't meet the criteria.
They will not.
But they'll still get health care plans.
That's right.
Yeah.
Okay. No, they won't lose all coverage. They will they will no longer have the coverage that they have now that they like.
Or not like.
That's right.
In the case of MiniMed, they don't like.
Well, it's a case of being held to a higher standard. They're going to have to get better care. And the implication when this argument is made by politicians is that people are going to lose the care they like now because it's high quality and it's going to go down in quality. It's either going to go down in quality or it's going to be taken away from them entirely. And that's simply not the case.
What about the tax increases?
There are, in fact, tax increases in this law. Very wealthy people are going to have to pay higher Medicare taxes. There are taxes that on the healthcare industry that are not so well liked. There is this very controversial tax that will go into effect in, I think it's the year 2018 or 2019, on a high-value health insurance plan. So there are, in fact, a fair number of taxes. Remember, this bill was paid for. It doesn't add to the deficit. So the money had to come from somewhere.
Let me ask a question, Mara. You know, it always struck me that you had a pretty good idea that the president should have campaigned on this, not in the very detailed way that we heard already in the little cut that we heard from today, where he's once again sort of on the defensive saying, you won't lose your coverage. Instead, why didn't they portray this as an anti-free rider fee? Because every insured American on average pays $1,000 more a year in coverage. Basically, in order to subsidize the people who didn't have coverage before. But they never did do that. So is there any indication they will do that now?
Well, first of all, they didn't do it before because they felt that uttering the word fee or tax, even if it was attached to an unbelievably conservative principle, was a loser for them and they couldn't get Democrats to vote for it. Now that this issue is being forced on them because the Supreme Court has called it a tax, I would think that they have to engage on this. I mean, otherwise, the same thing is going to happen all over again. You're going to have those talking points that you just heard Mitt Romney say repeated in ads all across the country, and all of a sudden, Americans are going to find out that something they didn't even know about before, oh, he's raising our taxes on health care. I mean, I think the president is going to have to get out there and explain what this is. The problem is, and Julie has chronicled this very well, is that because it was so expensive, they had to front-load the pay-fors and back-load the goodies, and they don't have anything to show people until 2014. The really big things to show people, like you now have coverage. You have a couple of the little goodies, like the donut hole is gone, but that's a problem for them because it's not going to be in place for people to learn that they like it for a couple of years.
All right, but what I also find interesting is that we, in addition to hearing Mitt Romney castigate this, you also heard him say that, okay, yes, people should, with pre-existing conditions, should have coverage.
Oh, we'll still have the goodies.
Should keep coverage. Yeah. I don't
but
think
how
he
has
said,
he said he's good?
He said he wants COBRA. This is, you have to really listen to him. He didn't say that people with a pre-existing condition should be able to go out and get coverage. What he said is, if you have coverage, we don't want you to lose it if
so
you
change jobs.
So if
you're a job creator with your own business and you have to self-insure...
Or if you're an employee who has coverage and then changes jobs, there is something called COBRA, which allows... It's like a stopgap plan that allows you to keep your coverage.
Yes, but only for a period.
But only for... I think it's the most...
18 months.
But I don't... Yes, go
but
ahead.
That's already law.
Yes, that's already law. It's very unclear
COBRA.
What he's offering.
No, but that's not COBRA. That's HIPAA from 1996. If you have coverage and you have a pre-existing condition, you can keep it beyond COBRA.
Do we know if Romney is talking about anything different than that?
There's no evidence that he's talking about anything different.
I want to make a prediction. Back to the court for a minute. The court may not be in the best odor in the country, but it still has a 44% approval rating, which is better than any other institution, including ours. Way better than ours, the Fourth Estate. So we've all seen massive television and radio campaigns that can change people's opinion. And so I don't know what the effect of the infusion of hundreds of millions of dollars against this might be. But overall, I suspect that there are a great many people who thought, gee, I think the president may have done something illegal here. And now the Supreme Court has said, no, it's legal, it's constitutional, Congress acted within its powers, and it was the Chief Justice of the United States, appointed by George W. Bush, who wrote the opinion saying that. And
you could see opinion shift.
You could see opinion.
But I don't want to let our time run out without asking a bit of a hypothetical here, Ron. We have no elections in November, and you have
Mitt Romney, the Republican Party, saying they want to overturn the law. Okay, the Supreme Court supports it. We'll change the law. Is that possible? What would happen? Can Mitt Romney give all 50 states a waiver to opt out of this if he gets elected?
If Mitt Romney gets elected president, I would hazard the guess that the House is going to remain quite Republican and the Senate is probably going to become slightly Republican, and they will proceed to repeal the law. They'll have to deal with the Democrats in the Senate. They'll do so. They'll find a way to get it done. And they will, at the very least, administratively, pull all the support that is necessary from the administration in order to get any of these policies to really take effect. So you need a president who wants to. You need a Congress that is at least somewhat supportive to carry this forward, whatever the Supreme Court said. All the Supreme Court did today was to say, we won't kill this on the spot, bang. And they came very close to doing it. If we just turn Roberts' vote, not only would they be knocking out the individual mandate, they'd be knocking out the entire law. Root and branch. That's what the other four, the dissenting justices, wanted to do. They'd have taken it all down to the ground. So the difference between that and what happened today is enormous, of course. But if you get the Republican backlash that at least in some quarters of the conservative half of the country is building, if you get that to have the effect in 2012 that we saw it have in 2010, then they'll be able to kill Obamacare.
And Mara, did I hear you say that because it's now considered a tax, it would take fewer votes in the Senate to overturn?
Well, it would take 51 votes instead of the supermajority, but don't forget it was passed by 51 votes. You can pass things through. If this was passed through reconciliation, it can be repealed through reconciliation.
It helps to have control of the Senate, but if we assume that the Republicans have that next year, then, as I say, I don't see any bar to them one way and another essentially repealing Obamacare as soon as it can be practically done in January.
The thing that this does is this puts health care front and center in the presidential campaign, because if Mitt Romney is elected, Obamacare is gone. If President Obama is reelected, Obamacare is the law of the land. That's about as simple as you can get.
And between now and then, how many people are going to see the effects of this law? Julie Rovner.
Well, there are a fair number who are already seeing the effects of this law. There are 3.1 million young adults who are still on their parents' health plan who have gotten insurance. There are about 5 million seniors who are seeing the donut hole be gradually closed. There are about 11 million people who are going to be getting checks in the next month. They have to go out by August 1st. These are rebate checks from insurers under this.
How convenient.
Yeah, it is convenient.
And guess what? Nobody will notice.
All right, we will talk more in a few moments about how this health care law will roll out at least until November. I'm Jennifer Ludden. You're listening to live special coverage of the Supreme Court's decision on the health care law from NPR News. From NPR News, this is special coverage. The Supreme Court upholds the Affordable Care Act. I'm Jennifer Ludden. Today's historic decision means the years-long process of implementing the health care law will continue at least for now. Julie Rovner, you were just reminding us what has happened so far, and let us know what's happening next as the health care law rolls out.
Well, now a lot of the action moves to the states. The states have to decide whether they're going to implement a health insurance exchange. These are the marketplaces where individuals and small businesses will go to basically shop for plans and enroll in plans and purchase their plans. States have a choice here. They can either put together an exchange themselves, or if they don't want to, the federal government will come in behind them and do it. They have to decide by November, actually by the middle of November, just a few days after the election, whether they're going to do that. That needs to be up and running by next year.
A few days before or after, you said?
After, yeah. Middle of November.
Wow.
and now they have to decide about this Medicaid expansion. That was considered mandatory. Now it's considered an option.
All right. Well, to find out more about where the states are right now, we're joined on the phone by Alan Weil. He's with the National Academy for State Health Policy, a nonpartisan think tank. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
So which states are ready for these deadlines coming up?
Well, states have already done a great deal. They've brought up programs for people with pre-existing conditions. They've tightened their insurance regulations. And they've got a lot of input from the public about how they view the rollout of the law, what their choices are. They've done a tremendous amount of analysis. The looming deadline that you just heard about of deciding whether or not to set up an insurance exchange will be here in less than 5 months. And I'd say there are about a dozen states that have clearly indicated this is something they want to do. They're right on track. There are a handful of states that have expressed very clearly that they're not interested in setting up their own exchanges. But the vast majority of states in the middle are considering their options. They've been having a lot of discussions. And if they can make up their minds quickly, they can meet these deadlines, and they can even implement on time if they draft on the work that the leading states have accomplished.
For the states that have been dragging their feet, and I know some of them state leaders have kind of, for political reasons, said they just are not interested in this. Do you think this court decision will impact that?
Well, you know, we call it dragging their feet, but in fact, states are given the choice of whether or not to do this in the law, and saying you don't want to isn't exactly dragging your feet. It can be making an active choice about the role the state wants to play in implementation. I do think many states have been waiting for today, and they now do understand that the law is in place, and if they don't take the implementation steps, in most cases, the federal government will come in and do it for them, and most states aren't very enthusiastic about the federal government playing a more active role.
What's your reaction to the court's decision to somewhat limit the Medicaid expansion? It seems to give states a little more leeway there. They can't be quite so penalized if they don't expand Medicaid.
Well, aside from us all being surprised at the outcome of the case, you discussed earlier in the hour the fiscal logic that drives states to say, yes, the incentive for states to expand Medicaid fiscally is very strong, and so it would lead us to expect the overwhelming majority of states, despite having concerns about the Medicaid expansion, to do it. But remember, as you have also been talking about, this is also a political decision, and the politics of the Medicaid expansion are much more complex, with providers and advocates for low-income people lining up in favor of a Medicaid expansion, but people who don't look favorably upon the rest of the law may view this as an opportunity for resistance.
Well, and we've said, okay, now we have this long-awaited court decision, but then there's the November elections coming up, which, as we've just been discussing, could also change everything all over again. I mean, if Republicans took control of Congress and the presidency and say they did repeal this, what's your sense of what states would do then?
Well, the best prediction for what states will do without an ACA is what they did before the ACA, which is quite variable. There are states that will take it upon themselves to use the resources they have in the federal law as it exists to push as far as they can to expanded coverage. And there are states that will focus more on controlling public sector costs and maybe private sector costs to the extent they have those tools. There will be big differences in how many people are uninsured across the states, big differences in the cost. The Affordable Care Act provides a lot of tools that states, when they come up with their own plans, say they want to use. They expand Medicaid, they give subsidies to lower income people. Without the federal Treasury supporting those efforts in these fiscal times, very few states will move, but maybe as the economy picks up, we'll see a reemergence of state experimentation just as we saw prior to the act.
All right. Alan Weil of the National Academy for State Health Policy, thanks so much for your time tonight.
You're very welcome.
Nina Totenberg?
Well, you know, there's one thing we haven't discussed at all, and it sort of gets overlooked. There is a huge chunk of the private economy that is involved with providing health services that's going to benefit enormously by this, or at least they think they do. And that includes insurance companies, hospitals, clinics, all kinds of things like that. You know, most hospitals are increasingly overwhelmed by the people who come into their emergency rooms and the hundreds of thousands of dollars or millions of dollars that they have to spend on individuals without reimbursement. And this plan would deal with that. Now, that's, in an odd sort of way, that's corporate America. And what I don't know is what corporate America will do in this election about, it's not going to do a lot overtly. After all, this is not a few millionaires who are going to give $10 million or $50 million or even $100 million to fund a super PAC. This is big business in America, and they wanted this. They supported this.
So we'll have to see where they come down. You know, what I heard there from Alan Weil and also throughout today's Republican reaction to this, Julie Rovner, was this issue of controlling costs and the criticism that the Affordable Care Act doesn't control costs. And many Democrats make the same argument. It doesn't go far enough. What's going to happen now with that issue?
Well, that's been the perennial argument on this law, that it does a better job expanding coverage than it does controlling costs. Truth be told, nobody has a very good feel for how best to control health care costs other than by, you know, taking health care away from people. You know, none of the other countries, even those that have universal health care coverage, have a good way to control spiraling health care costs. We're pretty good at inventing new ways to take care of people, you know, more expensive, better high-tech surgeries and drugs and procedures. We're not very good at limiting those, except for the places that overtly ration. That seems to be a discussion that we're not very able to have in this country. Barring that, it's very hard to figure out how to provide better quality care, in a more rational way, which is the attempt, the cost-controlling attempt in this law, but nobody thinks it's going to be the magic bullet.
Maura?
Yeah, no, I think cost control is clearly the next big discussion to have. But first, the theory of the Obama administration was you got to get everybody into the system, and then you can control costs because then you don't have the free rider problem. But that's definitely coming down the pike, and it's going to come down the pike because you're going to have a big discussion about entitlements and entitlement reform, and that's all about controlling Medicare costs. So that's the next big debate to have. The point that Nina made is really important, this thing about corporate America. I mean, this is one place where Mitt Romney is really siding with the base of the Republican Party versus the old, I don't know what you want to call them, the old interests of the Republican Party. NFIB, the small business lobby, the Tea Party, those are the people who are really animated by animus to the law. And corporate America, not unlike on immigration, corporate America is happy about this law. They were making plans. They were moving forward. They helped shape this law. And what's really interesting is, as far as I can tell, they're kind of not players in this political battle. They're on the sidelines. They're not telling Romney to cool it.
You don't think so?
At least not yet. A lot of them were making plans. What they want is certainty. We hear this all the time. Well, they had some certainty, and they were going ahead and planning for the new ACA world. Now he's saying that he, you know, if he's elected, he's gonna overturn it. It's really interesting to see what they'll do. I don't know anything about what's in John Roberts' head, but he is a defender of the rights and prerogatives of corporate America, and he certainly ruled in their favor in this one.
Yeah, there are people who say that this is something he understands because he represented corporate America. I actually have not a clue whether that's true or not, but that is one of the things. If you look at the rest of the court's docket, the decisions have been significantly in favor of corporate America, against class actions, for arbitration, making less accessibility to the courts, cutting down accessibility by consumers, by civil rights plaintiffs. And that all is something that, you know, corporate America wants, and he's been very sympathetic to that. Now, whether this falls in the same bailiwick, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't really think that the health, well, you can look at where the money's going to go and say, well, there's a lot of corporate interest here. I don't think that's how it really resonated inside the court or generally with the public. I will say that in terms of his background and his proclivities, that he really grew up with the federal government. And that's one really defining feature of him. He doesn't have a big hostility to congressional power. And he has generally voted in the direction of congressional power. And somebody who was a federal government lawyer and worked for an administration, it would have been a little bit remarkable for him to issue the opinion that invalidated the single largest economic piece of legislation in the past 80 years or something like that. And that is why I think this decision is of a piece of his broader background.
But it's so interesting, the reaction, you know, there was so much after the hearings. Democrats were warning the court shouldn't rule politically, and now today we have Democrats lauding Chief Justice Roberts, and Republicans really assailing him. Here is an op-ed put out today by the National Review magazine. It says, quote, "The Constitution does not give the court the power to rewrite statutes, and Roberts and his colleagues have therefore done violence to it. If the law has been rendered less constitutionally obnoxious, the court has rendered itself more so. Chief Justice Roberts cannot justly take pride in this legacy."
Well, I think that most of the country and history will probably disagree with that. I do think that it's important to focus on the point they're making. This was the argument of the dissenters, and that is that the majority has turned itself into pretzels here, that we thought this law was about the Commerce Clause. Whoops! And it wasn't a tax, but now it's a tax. And we had thought that this Medicaid expansion was a mandate. Now it's an option. And so the dissenters were very upset by what they viewed as really excessive efforts to save the law. John Roberts turns around and says, look, my job as a Supreme Court justice is not to look for ways to strike laws down. My job, as he expressed it, is to try and find ways to deem statutes constitutional.
When in doubt, it's upheld.
Yes, and find a theory. And so his theory was the taxing power.
Well, what about Citizens United?
Well, there are laws and there are laws.
Okay, you mentioned the Commerce Clause that we had so much in detailed discussion about here these past couple of months. Nina, the Commerce Clause was found to be unconstitutional by a majority here, so I guess we can't be forced to eat broccoli. What other impact might this have beyond healthcare? How significant is this?
Well, it's not clear to me. I mean, the Commerce Clause is part of the Constitution, and it says that the federal Congress can regulate commerce among the states, and the court has said for the last three quarters of a century that it can regulate the economy. And there's no doubt that insurance is part of the economy. But the court here said that assumes you are in the economy, and that people who have chosen to stay out of the insurance economy by not having insurance are not part of the economy, and therefore you cannot regulate them by mandating that they become active in the economy when they have chosen, in one of the lawyers' terms, to sit home in their underwear watching TV and not having insurance, that you should leave them alone. And the court said, you should leave them alone, but it is unclear to me how many subjects there are like this whether is healthcare actually unique, because everybody's going to use it at some point. As Justice Ginsburg put it today, it's just a question of when and how badly you'll need it and how much it's going to cost and how sick you're going to be. I can't think of anything else like
but,
that.
But, Tom, one of your colleagues suggested that this would make it harder to implement or impose some other social programs?
Well, there were two different ways that might happen. The one is this commerce power, but the decision of the five justices limiting the commerce power really does seem to be, as Nina says, about mandates to buy things. So if we need another automobile bailout, we're not going to be able to tell Americans they have to buy cars. There's also the second part of the decision, and that's the Medicaid piece of it, and that might have some lasting significance we're going to have to see, because Congress is constantly telling states, we would like you to do something. You don't have to, but we are going to take away this $5 billion if you don't. And today's decision with seven members of majority suggests they're going to take that question seriously for the first time ever. And that does underlie a lot of social programs. And if there were really restrictions on how many strings Congress could put on the money, that could make a big difference.
Can we talk briefly about Justice Anthony Kennedy, who we thought would be, many people thought would be the swing vote? He wrote a very pointed dissent today, Nina.
Well, actually, four of them together. It was a joint dissent, but he was the one who spoke it from the bench. And it was sort of, I
had an odd sense. I felt that he was, on the one sense, angry, the way dissenters are when they lose, but that he was very uncomfortable. And I don't know what to make of that. And he seemed uncomfortable in the oral argument. He did seem undecided in the oral argument. He came out today all guns blazing. He joined the dissenters in, you know, they wrote this together, and it has the mark of several different writing styles in it. Tom?
Well, I would say that in the end, he, the center vote in the court generally, and he was in dissent here, which is extremely rare, he decided this was a case about individual liberty. It was about the relationship between a government and its people, and that something had happened here that had never happened before, and the government had reached out and said, you must do this. You must buy this product. And that's what the lawyers for the plaintiffs did so well in almost winning this case, is turning it into something very much about a basic notion of what it is to be a free American, in a very Tea Party-ish sense. And I think he does have discomfort at the idea of striking down such an important law, but he just thought that this was dramatic government overreach in the end.
Julie Rovner, you deal every day with people who are in the healthcare world. This law is big in their lives. What have you taken away from the reaction today?
I think most of the people in the healthcare industry and who work in healthcare were expecting it to be either struck down or expecting at least the individual mandate to be struck down. I think this really came as a surprise to most people. Everybody had all these contingency plans ready and waiting to go ahead, and everybody was like, "Wow, now what do we do?"
Well, I didn't you get a huge sense of relief, because their contingency plans, they really did acknowledge, didn't work.
Yeah, there was a lot of palpable fear, even from people in the healthcare sphere who were not really thrilled with this law. There was a lot of serious concern about some of the ramifications, some of the unintended consequences of either taking the law down or even trying to take the law apart. There were big, big worries about some of the things that could happen.
Okay.
Putting Humpty Dumpty back together again would have been super hard.
Especially with only a few of the pieces, as
yes,
many people
exactly
thought would be
right.
The case. Mara, any last thoughts?
I just am curious to see, first of all, if polling changes because of this ruling, and also to see what lessons the White House learned from the first kind of battle that they lost around messaging around this bill, around this law, and if they're going to do anything differently in the way they talk about it between now and November.
The big, in some ways, the very big winner in the short run is Chief Justice Roberts, who's getting great press from most of the commentariat today. It's true. The hard right is really not happy with him.
And they'll fall back in love, though.
They will fall back in love. And the people who normally don't have anything good to say about him are just praising him to the skies.
NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg, attorney Tom Goldstein, publisher of SCOTUS Blog, health policy correspondent Julie Rovner, and national political correspondent Mara Liasson. Thank you all so very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
And we were also joined by NPR Washington editor Ron Elving. The program was edited by Joe Neal and produced by Giselle Grayson, with help from Natalie Friedman. Elaine Heinzman directed, and Melissa Markey was the engineer. I'm Jennifer Ludden. It's been live special coverage of the Supreme Court's decision to uphold the Affordable Care Act. It's NPR News.